All right, so we're in week number two of the intertestamental overview, survey. So we got started last week, and just with a quick review, we're studying the intertestamental period, which is the silent years, as we discussed, between the Old and New Testaments. So we're talking here about a gap, about the period of where we had a gap of revelation. And I was thinking about that. We haven't had any revelation since the New Testament. And what's different about the gap between the Testaments and the fact that we don't have revelation, new revelation today? What's significant about this gap for studying? In terms of, if you think about it in terms of revelation, there was revelation up to the end of the Old Testament, and then there was silence for some 460 years. We have silence today in terms of revelation. What's the difference? That's right. So there's a sense of incompleteness to the revelation that had been given. And then you can sort of see how a Jew living in that time would feel this tension, knowing that we've had this revelation, and then the revelation has stopped. But everything isn't as it should be. Things are still messed up, and we haven't really seen the fulfillment of any of the promises of God that relate, to the kingdom and things like that. So it's a very significant gap of revelation that we're studying. We looked at the tie-in between the Elijah to come, the closing words of the Old Testament, and then the opening of the New Testament with John the Baptist. And so I gave a little bit of an apology for why it's important to study this period, our ignorance, the fact that there's a lot of important literature that was written during this period, and most importantly, that it explains the context for understanding the New Testament. And look back one second there. We have the fact that the Old Testament closes under Persian rule, but the New Testament opens under Roman rule. And there's no explanation of how that happened and how that transition affected the context of Jesus' ministry. We talked a little bit about that last week. And then the other fact we have is that there's so many things that that we find when we open the pages of the New Testament that are absent from the Old Testament. We talked about some of them. Synagogues, scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, the Sanhedrin, the rise of all these groups that are really not explained in the Bible. And so it's important. All of those things grew out of the intertestamental period, and we'll be looking at these in more detail in the coming weeks. And so that brings us to the approach, and we were just starting to talk about that last Sunday. We talked a little bit about the work of a historian in general, how difficult it is to get to what really happened, particularly with ancient history. And we talked about some of the specific challenges in this period, how that there's a large amount of complex material to go through, and it's very difficult to get a handle on it if you're not an expert in the topic. And then we talked about the fact that much of the historical material is heavily biased, and there are very limited perspectives to discern those biases. You can discern a bias if you have more than one source to look at, and you can compare them and figure out which ones of them are most likely to be true. But in this case, we have very limited perspectives to identify these biases, and we mentioned Josephus as a good example of that. And then the other thing we mentioned is that a lot of the scholarship in this period is liberal, and so it's biased with basically an unbelieving presupposition is what is brought to the material. And so we talked some about how that influences the way that history is interpreted. And the book of Daniel is a really good example of that. How, if you don't accept the supernatural or true prophecy, then Daniel must have been written after the events occurred because it's so accurate that that's what an unbelieving presupposition brings to it. And then that colors the way that you interpret the history. And so we talked a little bit about that last week. And then that brings us to the next point, which was kind of where we left off. which is on dating. I have a few words to say about dating. There, you'll find a lot of discrepancies in this period on dating. And what I've tried to do here is list the most likely dates. In some cases, there's discrepancies that I'm aware of, but I haven't tried to do a bunch of original research to come to my own conclusion on some of these dates. So I've put what I believe is the most likely date in some of the material that we'll be going through. But you will see, you might, if you're attentive, you might find apparent discrepancies in some of the events because the dates are slightly off. That's because there are some questions about how things should be dated. Another thing to say on the dating is if you're doing any independent study on your own or looking in your study Bible, you might find it's very common to have a one-year difference in dates. So just to point that out, you'll have, some people will say, like for the cleansing of the temple in the Maccabean period, you'll see some people say that happened in 168 BC. You'll see other people that say it happened in 167 BC. And basically, don't get worked up about the one-year problem there. A lot of that is due to the fact that the dating that we have isn't according to a calendar, it's according to like a reign of someone. So, or it's an event that happened. So you'll say, you know, like you'll read this in the Bible, like in the second year of Darius's reign. Well, Darius didn't start reigning on a January. So the second year actually spans two calendar years. And so you have to make a decision if you're just going to put one number down, which year do I put down for identifying that. So just a caution that you'll see some issues in the dating as we go forward. And then the final thing was, I alluded to this last week, but it's very challenging to organize all this material. There's so many individual things that require really detailed individual study, but it's really hard to study any one thing without studying everything at the same time to get all to see how all the pieces go together. And so what we're going to try to do here in the approach for this course is kind of go through the historical overview first. So we'll be just doing a lot of history, like what actually happened in history. And then what we'll do is we'll kind of note some of the important developments along the way. But then we'll really have we'll go back later. After we get the lay of the land for the history, we'll go back later and look at some of the cultural things that were going on, for instance, in Judaism at the time. We'll mention some of them along the way, but we'll kind of tie it all together later. So if you feel unsatisfied with going through a historical period and like, well, what was happening with, you know, the temple at that time? We'll come back to that after we get the broad lay of the land, because a lot of it's interrelated with the history. So because of that approach, there's necessarily going to be some overlap. We're going to sort of cover things from multiple angles a couple times. So that brings us up to the outline. So are there any questions about anything from last week or that I've said so far today? Any clarifications or comments or questions? Okay, good. So the outline of what we're going to be doing is given there. What we're going to do is the Old Testament background, first of all, that leads up to this period. That's mainly what our topic will be for today. And then we're going to look at some of the important sources for this material during this period. We'll go through some of the historians, some of the literature that's out there, and then we're going to spend a fair amount of time looking at the life of Josephus because he's such an important character in this period. And then what we'll do is really delve into the historical piece of it. So we'll do a historical summary. I just changed this outline last week, so I'll get this right here. We're going to do the historical summary up to the Maccabean period. And then we're going to pause and look at some of the developments in Judaism that led up to that period because it's such a critical time period and there were all kinds of important things that were going on that led up to the Maccabean revolt. And then we'll pick up again and continue the historical summary up to the Roman period, basically up to the New Testament. And then we'll take a pause there and go back and look at some of the religious and cultural developments that were happening during that period. We'll be looking at things like the rise of all the parties within Judaism, the Herodian dynasty, all those things that we all have questions about and we see in the New Testament, but we don't really know any context for it. And then we'll look at some of the, we'll look specifically at some of the literature that developed in the period in a little more detail. So one of the things we'll look at in some detail is the apocryphal books that are in the Roman Catholic Bible. Most of those books were written during this period. And then we'll wrap it up with bringing it into the New Testament. What was happening? How did all of this lead up to the New Testament and the coming of the kingdom? Okay, so with that, I can hand out the next handout. Okay, so what we're going to be covering today is the Old Testament background. And so this is the events that led up to the intertestamental period. And we've got a couple of major headings here. The two things that we'll probably get through today are the return from exile and then the rebuilding of the temple. And I'll be handing out another table. Okay, so first of all, in terms of the background, you can cheat because I gave you the handout, but where do we read about the return, about the exile and the return from exile? What are some of the key books that we're interested in the Old Testament? Especially if somebody didn't cheat, I'm interested to hear the answer. Nobody? Ezra and Nehemiah are very important books, yeah. Even before that, there was an expectation of a return from exile. So let's take a look at Jeremiah. I'm just going to be reading a few passages here. Jeremiah chapter 25. So Jeremiah 25, we'll read a couple passages from Jeremiah. So you remember the situation with Jeremiah. He was prophesying under siege in Jerusalem, and there had already been people taken to Babylon. And so here we have in chapter 25, he's talking about the length of time of the exile. And in verse 11, so Jeremiah 25, verse 11, it says, "This whole land shall become a ruin and a waste, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then after 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity, declares the Lord, making the land an everlasting waste. I will bring upon that land all the words that I have uttered against it, everything written in this book, which Jeremiah prophesied against all the nations. For many nations and great kings shall make slaves even of them, and I will recompense them according to their deeds and the work of their hands." So here we have, first of all, prophecy of the destruction that's coming and the judgment that's coming from the Lord. But we have this time period named here that the nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And then after the 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon. Now, if you remember, Jeremiah actually wrote this message to the exiles in Babylon. Flip over to chapter 29. We find Jeremiah's letter to the exiles. So in verse 10, he says, "Thus says the Lord, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and all the places where I have driven you, declares the Lord, and I will bring you back to the place from which I sent you into exile." So we have a promise of the Lord that the exile is going to end, and the time period is 70 years, and he's going to bring them back to the land and restore their fortunes. Now, that was the exiles read this letter that Jeremiah sent. And so then you remember another event that happened after this in Daniel. You remember that Daniel was in exile in Babylon, and he read this letter of Jeremiah, just like all of the exiles probably did or had access to it, verbal access. But if you remember, Daniel thought about this, and in chapter 9 of Daniel, it says this. This is Daniel speaking. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, by descent a Mede, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the number of years that, according to the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet, must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. And so Daniel, having access to Jeremiah's letter and this prophecy, realized, hey, the 70 years are up. What's going on? And then if you recall, we're not going to cover this, but if you recall, what Daniel does after this is he gives a huge prayer of repentance, because he realizes that although the Jews have been in exile in Babylon these 70 years, they still haven't repented. Their hearts are still hard towards the Lord. And that's what follows in this book. So Daniel realized that the main point here is that Daniel realized that the 70 years are coming to an end. Now, there's some debate here about when the 70 years is actually, when it started and when it ended. There's a couple different interpretations of that. One of them is that it started in 605 at the first deportation of Israelites to Babylon, and then it ends at the return, at the very first return. So that's about 70 years. The other way that you can do it, that some people do it, is that it begins at the destruction of the temple, which is a little bit later. So then the end point of that is that when the temple was rebuilt, or the foundations of the temple were laid. So you can calculate 70 years a couple different ways. We're not exactly sure what the right interpretation is, but you'll find those two ways of calculating it if you look in your study Bibles and things like that. Now, the other interesting thing that we know from the Old Testament, from the book of Isaiah in particular, is that God's instrument of deliverance is named. And who is that? From the book of Isaiah. Who is God's instrument of deliverance from the exile? I'll give you a hint. It's a Persian king. It's Cyrus, okay? In Isaiah 44, verse 28, Cyrus is called by name, and he's called there. Interesting terminology is used of Cyrus in the Old Testament. There, in that passage, he's called the shepherd, my shepherd. A very interesting name to use, or title to use, for a pagan king. Shepherds, you remember, shepherds are often reserved for priests or possibly Israelite kings. Cyrus is called the shepherd. And then even more interestingly, in chapter 45, verse 1, Cyrus is named again, and he's called the Lord's anointed. So he's anointed by the Lord to be the deliverer, the instrument of deliverance. And so we have that prophecy way before, and then we know, and then we have Daniel recognizing that the end of the exile was upon them. And then we have this amazing series of events that led to the return of the Jews from Babylon. We're going to look more at this. We'll look at a more detail around this when we look at Cyrus. When we look at the Persian dynasty, we'll cover this in a little more detail. But for right now, let's just look at the scriptures, what they say about this event. So you remember that this happens at the end of Chronicles. So if you turn to the end of 2 Chronicles, And then you recognize that also, you know, that Second Chronicles leads right in naturally into Ezra. Some people believe that Second Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah were all originally one document. But anyways, at the end of Second Chronicles, we have the ending, and then in Ezra, we pick up again in more detail. So if we look at the end of Second Chronicles, chapter 36, we'll just read the last two verses here. This is where this happened. It's interesting, we have a commentary just before that about the desolation of the land for those 7 years. And you remember this terminology that the land was able to enjoy its Sabbath rest because it was kept desolate. And that's what it says in verse 21. The land, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths, all the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 7 years. It's an interesting editorial comment on the fact that the Jews had not been keeping the Sabbath, which is part of the reason that the judgment came on the land. Anyways, that's just for free. In verse 22, we read, "Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up." Okay, so one of the interesting things here, we see this throughout the Bible, of course, but it's called, the theological term is divine concurrence. We see how these events are happening in the world, but they're completely happening to fulfill the word of the Lord. So God is working behind the scenes to return his people from exile, and he's using the Persian king Cyrus to accomplish his will. So God is sovereignly working through Cyrus to return his people from their exile. It's kind of interesting to note also Josephus in his Antiquities states that Cyrus had actually read the prophecy of Isaiah that he, that is Cyrus, would decree the return. So it's kind of that's always something you wonder about, right? That Cyrus was named well before this event, and then it happens. We have the same situation with Alexander the Great in the Bible. And Josephus records that Cyrus had actually read this prophecy of Isaiah that he would decree the return and was interested in it. We don't know if that's true or not. It's probably not. It's probably a legend that Josephus was propagating. But anyways, if we go to Ezra then, Ezra picks up right where 2 Chronicles left off. It sort of repeats, but then it expands and provides more details on the return from the exile. So here I'm going to read the whole first chapter of Ezra. It's pretty short. "In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And let each survivor, in whatever place he sojourns, be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods and with beasts, besides freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. Then rose up the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up to rebuild the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. And all who were about them aided them with vessels of silver, with gold, with goods, with beasts, and with costly wares, besides all that was freely offered. Cyrus the king also brought out the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods. Cyrus, king of Persia, brought these out in the charge of Mithridath, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And this was the number of them: 30 basins of gold, 1,000 basins of silver, 29 censers, 30 bowls of gold, 410 bowls of silver, and 1,000 other vessels. All the vessels of gold and of silver were 5,400. All these did Sheshbazzar bring up when the exiles were brought up from Babylonia to Jerusalem. So here we have an expanded version of what happened there with Cyrus. And you can tell Cyrus not only permitted the Jews to go back, but he actually commanded that they be helped with all kinds of wealth and all that kind of thing. And so Josephus comments on this as well. He actually records a letter from Cyrus to the governors of Syria that states his decree and commands supports from the governors of the land that were back in the area of Palestine. It's very similar to the later decree of Darius that we find in Ezra chapter 6. You might remember that Darius, during the rebuilding of the temple, we'll look at this in a little while, but that the people wrote to King Darius and said, "Hey, do you know these Jews are building this temple again? What's going on with that?" And Darius replies and he says, "Stay away from them. And by the way, you need to provide them all this wealth to not hinder them in the work." And so Josephus records a very similar letter from Cyrus to the governors of Syria that relate to this return. Again, we don't really know if that's a historical document or if it's just a legendary thing. But it's very interesting. It kind of expands on what we read here in the scriptures. And then I'll cover this one other interesting fact, and then we can take questions. We have this amazing archaeological find called the Cyrus Cylinder. And we're going to talk more about that in the future when we get to Persia. But this is a cylinder of clay that it dates from the reign of Cyrus. And here's what it says that's related to this. From Babylon, so this is a secular record, a secular historical record that corroborates the Old Testament. From Babylon, I sent back to their places. This is, by the way, printed on the first handout, if you want to read it. From Babylon, I sent back to their places, to the sanctuaries across the river Tigris, whose shrines had earlier become dilapidated, the gods who lived therein and made permanent sanctuaries for them. I collected together all of their people and returned them to their settlements. And so here we have a statement of the policies of Cyrus, the great king of Persia. And it definitely corroborates this sort of benevolence that we read about in the Old Testament towards the Jews. I mentioned, we'll talk more about the Cyrus Cylinder, but Ginny pointed out to me last week after the class that the Cyrus Cylinder is actually in the United States right now, touring. It's normally in the British Museum, and it's in Washington, D.C. right now. So she just happened to, she's always reading, you know, archaeological stuff. And she mentioned that to me afterwards. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about the importance of the cylinder later when we come under Persia. But this is a very interesting historical record that lines up well with what we read about in Ezra, about the return from exile. Okay, any questions or comments before we look at the next topic? So I have a little bit of an excursus here, but this is something I wonder if you've ever noticed this. We just read about Sheshbazzar as having had the things counted out for him. If you know your Old Testament, maybe somebody here will be able to answer this question. Who is the main figure in the rebuilding of the temple later after this return? Does anybody remember? There's actually two people. What's that? No? Did you say Levi? Oh, Nehemiah. No. Nope. We're talking here about the rebuilding of the temple. It's another famous person. But anyways, it's Zerubbabel. So when you read the rest of the history of the rebuilding, you'll find basically there's two people. There's Joshua the priest and Zerubbabel, who are closely related. But Zerubbabel is the governor that you might recall. So we just read about Sheshbazzar. One of the kind of open questions is how these two people are related to one another. So I have a little bit of an excursus here because I thought it might be of interest to you. I've always been curious about this. Maybe nobody else has, but I've always wondered how Sheshbazzar was related to Zerubbabel. So I'll spend a few moments on this. Sheshbazzar in Ezra here is called the Prince of Judah in verse 8 of the section we just read. Sheshbazzar, the Prince of Judah. And he was commissioned by Cyrus to lead the return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. We just read that. Ezra chapter 1 here. Now, some believe that he is to be identified with a son of Jehoiakim. Does anybody remember who Jehoiakim is? He was the king. Which king? He was the one. No, that was Zedekiah. That was the final king. If you remember, Jehoiakim was exiled to Babylon earlier. He was taken into Babylon earlier. So he was from the royal line of David. And some believe that this Sheshbazzar, the Prince of Judah, is actually a son of Jehoiakim, because there is a son similar to this named Shenazar in 1 Chronicles. If you look in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, there's a genealogy there of the kings. And there's a son of Jehoiakim named Shenazar. And so some people believe that this is actually a son of Jehoiakim who was commissioned to lead the return of the exiles back to Jerusalem. And that, by the way, that would have made him an uncle of Zerubbabel, because Zerubbabel is a grandson of Jehoiakim. So there's pros and cons to that view. I'm not sure if it's right. But at any rate, Sheshbazzar is the Prince of Judah and was commissioned by Cyrus to lead the return. Now, we're more familiar probably with Zerubbabel, because we read a lot about him during the rebuilding of periods. So he's also from the royal line of David. He's listed, actually Zerubbabel is listed in both of the genealogies of Jesus in the New Testament. So he's in the line of Jesus. He's the grandson of Jehoiakim, and that again comes from the genealogy in 1 Chronicles chapter 3. And he is the main leader who is said to have led the return from exile and rebuild the temple. And you might remember about Zerubbabel that he's also the subject of imagery. He's an image of the restoration of the Davidic kingship. You may recall from Haggai that he's called a signet ring, which is a royal figure that is coming back to restore the Davidic kingship. Or not restore, but he's an image of the Davidic kingship. I mentioned earlier that he's usually mentioned in connection with Joshua or Joshua the priest all throughout the later book of Ezra. And if you look at the book of Haggai, he's closely associated with Joshua the priest. And then so the question is, how are these two characters related? Are they, some people think they're the same person. And there's some information that seems to corroborate that view. Both of them are called governors. Sheshbazzar is called a governor in Ezra chapter 5, and Zerubbabel is called a governor multiple times in Haggai. And both of them, from what we've seen, both of them seem to have been leaders of the return from exile. And both of them were involved in rebuilding the temple. And in fact, each of them is credited with laying the foundations of the temple individually in different places. Sheshbazzar in Ezra and Zerubbabel in Zechariah. Another interesting thing is that they never appear together in the text. The fact that they're never together means that they could be the same person, because they're never found at the same place at the same time. And so it's often suggested that Sheshbazzar is a Babylonian name and Zerubbabel is the Jewish name of the same individual. Okay, does that make sense? So, you know, people have different names. Think of Daniel. He had two different names, his Jewish name and his Babylonian name. Some people suggest that that might be going on here with Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel. And then the final point of identifying them together is that Josephus sort of identifies them as the same person in his antiquities. On the other hand, there's information that suggests that they're different persons. We just talked about the name. So the problem with that theory is that both Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar are Babylonian names. So that the Hebrew thing doesn't really make sense there. So probably they're two different individuals. There's a book in the Apocrypha called 1 Esdras, 1 Esdras, that distinguishes the two. This is actually another version of the letter that we mentioned earlier, Tatanai's letter to Darius. We'll take a look at that in a second. But this is another version of that. This book actually distinguishes the two people. And then Sheshbazzar, this is sort of my take on it. Sheshbazzar seems to have been commissioned by Cyrus with Zerubbabel accompanying the returned exiles. But then Sheshbazzar seems to be absent. One interesting thing, if you read through this history in the Bible, Sheshbazzar kind of disappears from the scene. He's only here at the very beginning. And then Zerubbabel seems to be carrying on the work. And when Sheshbazzar is referred to in this letter from Tatnai to Darius, back to the king, when they were questioning whether the temple should be allowed to be rebuilt, they actually refer to Sheshbazzar in that. Actually, I'll read that passage here. It's in Ezra chapter 5. We find this letter from Tatnai to King Darius. Tatnai was one of the people, one of the governors of the land who was questioning whether the Jews should be rebuilding the temple. Read, look at Ezra chapter 5, verses 14 through 16. It's interesting how they refer to Sheshbazzar here. So Zerubbabel is on the scene. Back in chapter 5, verse 2, Zerubbabel and Jeshua are rebuilding the house of God. And it's in that context that we read this in this kind of interesting thing in the letter. In chapter 14, in verse 14, and the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought into the temple of Babylon, these Cyrus the king took out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered to one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. And he said to him, take these vessels, go and put them in the temple that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt on its site. Then this Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God that is in Jerusalem. And from that time until now, it has been in building, and it is not yet finished. What's interesting about the way that Tatnai refers to Sheshbazzar here when he's in the presence of Zerubbabel? You do some detective work. Notice how he refers to Sheshbazzar. He delivered these treasures to one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. Does that sound like somebody that knows Sheshbazzar? And then this Sheshbazzar came. Does that sound like he's referring to someone he knows? Or someone who's associated with Zerubbabel? It doesn't sound like it. It sounds like Sheshbazzar here. Remember, this is years later after the return. I don't know how many. This is like 16 years later. So it sounds like at this point in the history, Sheshbazzar is sort of history himself. He's in history himself. So this is just another reason, I think, to separate these two individuals. So I think that it's likely that Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar are different individuals who are to be distinguished. It seems like Sheshbazzar was commissioned by Cyrus to lead the return, and Zerubbabel likely returned with him as the royal leader in conjunction with Jeshua the priest. So we have the two people who are actually going to carry out the rebuilding. And then Sheshbazzar doesn't seem to really figure in this response to the renewed call that we find here that is coincident with this letter to King Darius under Haggai and Zechariah's ministries. So probably that may suggest that Shesbassar was maybe an older man who had either passed away or had perhaps even returned to Persia at that time. And then Zerubbabel seems to be the main leader after the return. And Zerubbabel and Joshua are the main leaders who respond to Haggai and Zechariah's call to rebuild the temple, which is coincident with this letter here to Darius, and to handle the later opposition that happened. So, anyways, that's a little excursus there. It's something that has always been confusing to me. Hopefully you'll remember that next time you're reading through here. So Cyrus's decree to return was issued in 538 BC. And so the return probably happened fairly quickly as soon as they could get organized. So probably we're talking about the 538 to 537 BC range for the return of the Jews. And one thing to remember is that not everyone returned. You probably are well aware of that. But remember, name off some of the people who never returned to the land as far as we know. There's some famous people that were not in Jerusalem during the Persian period. And who were some of them? Who were some of the people that never went back to the land? Esther. Esther and Mordecai were in Persia. They never returned. Who's one other really famous one that went into exile and never returned as far as we know? Daniel. So we have people like Daniel, we have people like Esther, we have people like Nehemiah. He returned, but he wasn't living in the land. He was serving the king of Persia when he returned. So remember that when people returned from the exile, there was still a strong Jewish presence dispersed throughout the world, and particularly in the Persian Empire. Probably they had comfortable lives and they had positions of responsibility. We know that's true of Daniel and Nehemiah, and they just chose not to come back for some reason or another. Okay, so that's the return from exile, and then the next thing we'll pick up is the rebuilding of the temple. Does anybody have any questions or comments about the return from exile? Okay. So I'm going to hand out a new handout here, which is a table that I want you to keep reference for the next couple weeks. All right, this is just sort of a reference tape, a couple of reference tables to that we'll be referring to in the next couple weeks. The one that we're interested in now is the one that says Table 1, the Persian rulers in the Old Testament timeline. Okay, so here we're going to just kind of keep that in front of you. It kind of has what I've got there is the Persian rulers on the left, the approximate date in the middle there, and then the biblical reference to it, and then just comments off to the right. I like having this in front of me because I get confused about the Persian rulers and what order they came in and everything like that. So this kind of helps keep you straight. So, what is our main biblical source for the rebuilding of the temple? What book do we read about, do we use mostly to read about the rebuilding of the temple? Shout it out. Ezra, that's right. So Ezra is our main biblical source for the rebuilding of the temple. One thing that you need to remember, and that this is part of the chronology that we get confused on, I get confused on, is that Ezra wasn't actually there. We think of Ezra as rebuilding the temple. Remember, Ezra wasn't there when they laid the foundations of the temple. He came 70 years later. Okay? So just remember, that's something that you don't, you know, when we just read the book of Ezra, you don't really pick up that, oh, there's a 70-year gap here. He wasn't actually there on the scene until 7 years later. You can see that in the table. Ezra doesn't show up until way down there at 458 BC. Okay? So that's something to keep in mind here. Josephus gives us a much expanded version of the interactions between the Persian kings and the Jews, the return and the rebuilding of the temple. And is that footnote? Is there a footnote there on your handout? Yeah, that footnote is there. So, yeah, Josephus gives an expanded version of there. It's very interesting that he jumbles his chronology of the kings, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But if you're interested in getting an expanded version of any of this stuff that you read in Ezra and Nehemiah, Josephus is a good source. He expands upon it, and it's hard to tell how much of it is true, but it's a very plausible story, history that he tells. He may have had other sources that he's relying on. But anyway, so the Jews are back there, and then the first thing that happened, we find in Ezra chapter 3, is that the altar was rebuilt. I'll just briefly read here. Ezra 3, verses 1 through 3. When the seventh month came and the children of Israel were in the towns, the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. Then arose Jeshua the son of Jozadak with his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel with his kinsmen, and they built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. They set the altar in place, for fear was on them because of the peoples of the lands, and they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening. You see, the priority of the returnees from the exile was to get the altar rebuilt so that they could offer sacrifices. You even get a hint here of the fact that they wanted to be offering sacrifices because they were under constant threat of attack from their adversaries. And so the altar was rebuilt first, and then right after this, the foundations of the temple were laid in the second year of the return. So this is probably in the 537 BC timeframe. And this is picked up here in the following verses of this chapter, starting in verse 8. Now in the second year after their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, made a beginning, together with the rest of their kinsmen, the priests and the Levites, and all who had come to Jerusalem from the captivity. They appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to supervise the work on the house of the Lord. And Jeshua, with his sons and brothers, and Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together supervised the workmen in the house of God, along with the sons of Henadad and the Levites, their sons and brothers. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments came forward with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord, according to the directions of David, king of Israel. And they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundations of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first house, wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping, for the people shouted with a great shout, and the sound was heard far away. So we have the relaying of the foundation of the temple of the Lord, and you can hear the note of emotional sadness there at the people who had actually seen the Solomon's temple prior to the destruction. Okay, so the foundations of the temple were laid, and then we have here the beginning of opposition to the rebuilding of the temple. This is an interesting section in the book of Ezra. This is in chapter 4. This is a very confusing section, and the chronology here is all out of order, you may remember. We'll pick up here next week. Keep your tables and bring them back. We'll continue to refer to them, as well as handout number 2. We'll pick up here at the rebuilding of the temple, and we'll talk specifically about the chronology here in Ezra chapter 4.